welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and today is March 9, 2010, and this is episode 350. More about this program and the guests that have provided us with such fascinating conversations can be found on our website, www.exogenynetwork.com. The Dawn of Shades always tries to bring interesting people right to the audience to hear about both new and old ideas. We focus on the people, places, and ideas that don't often make the mainstream news, sorts of things that are frequently labeled as alternative or paranormal. For the show tonight, if you would like to have a question asked, you can email me at giascott@gmail.com or through the virtual auditorium on Pal Talk by text. I do monitor the email during the program, so if you're listening outside of the virtual auditorium and would like to have a question answered, please email it to me and I'll ask the question for you. In the virtual auditorium, just put it in text. I'll try and catch it as the screen scrolls. And for those of you who are listening to this on podcast after the fact, go ahead and email it to me. I'll try and get an answer for you anyhow. Now, many of you like to feel connected, so I am on Facebook and Twitter. You can link to me there. I also have a MySpace page. I have to admit, though, I don't use it a whole lot. It's there. There's also a Dawn of Shades fan page on Facebook, so you can look for that as well. If you like to read, I've got articles on a wide variety of topics available, and you can find links on the website. Just click on my name. And if you're a foodie, you'll have to take a look at some of the food articles and find out what kinds of things I've been cooking up lately, at least the good stuff anyhow. The things labeled as failures, you'd have to talk to Red Dog about, since she enjoys failure in this case and doesn't write much. She doesn't have much to say. Often I have had people inquire about the topics that we've introduced on the Dawn of Shades and its relevance to our daily life, as they insist that the average person has very little interest in topics such as cosmic consciousness, spirituality, string theories, multidimensional entities, extraterrestrial beings, and other off-the-beaten-path sorts of topics. On this lack of interest of the common man, as he or she is called, I beg to differ. Maybe I run into more intellectual sorts, and maybe I don't. I really consider myself among that group referred to as the common man. This past weekend, I participated in a group campout with a loosely organized group of people that I also feel qualify as members of that group. It included people from such fields as communications, shipbuilding, mechanics, sales, retail, service, and students. Hardly a group that most people would as a group of intellectuals. What did we talk about? Lots of things. We talked about conservation, the importance of youth programs to teach appreciation of wilderness areas, the National Healthcare Plan, tips, construction, various gear manufacturers, string theory, spirituality, cosmic consciousness, how multiple dimensions would work, the source of precognitive information, the voice of God, and what it would be, and just about every guest I've had on this program in the last year came up sometime during the weekend, along with the books that they've written. Did we fix the world's woes? Of course not. Was it unusual for this group of people to talk of these things? Of course not. These are not topics exclusively for the intellectuals of the world. These are all topics that all of us think about and often talk of with others. Conversations similar to the ones I had this weekend often contribute heavily to the topics that are then heard on this program. There are topics that people really are curious about, whether it's an electrical engineer, a salesman who's telling you your retirement package, the mechanic that works on your car, the woman who fits you with your new running shoes, or the student who shovels the snow for you on Saturday morning. These topics do have relevance in our day-to-day existence. Most of us have a base education on which to base a lifetime of learning by the time we're in our mid-teens, long before we have officially finished with school. These tools are given to us in order to enable us to better understand the world we live in. And by choosing to educate ourselves in a broad spectrum of topics, we have the luxury of an open mind capable of learning new things longer. We may have an aging population in America these days, but it does not have to be a rigid society incapable of flexing and learning. We just need to keep exercising those brain cells. Tonight's guest has written a book that has a title that just intrigues: Cosmic Conversations, Dialogues on the Nature of the Universe and the Search for Reality. That's a title that just says, yes, here's a mental triathlon for my brain cells, and it delivers exactly what it promises. So, without further ado, let me welcome Stephen Martin to the Dawn of Shades. Stephen, How are you this evening?
I'm doing well. It's great to be joining you. Thanks, Chia.
Good. The first thing I'd like you to do is introduce yourself to the audience and make sure you tell them where to find your book and your website.
Okay. Well, my name is Stephen Martin, and I'm an astronomer and professor of astronomy at a small community college here in southeastern Massachusetts, where it's still New England winter or spring. And I've been involved with science pretty much my whole life. I wanted to be an astronomer ever since I was a little kid. I went to school for physics and astronomy and grad school for that, and did research on dark matter and all kinds of mysterious things, and worked for the Hubble Space Telescope. So I've had a pretty long and varied career. And asking these kinds of cosmic questions, you know, what is the universe and what's my relationship to it, is really, you know, this question has really been with me for a long time. And so writing this book was really the culmination of that kind of exploration, at least this stage of it. I mean, it's infinite, so it keeps going, but this is kind of one end of an era in answering these questions.
Yeah, questions get easier as life goes on, maybe, but the answers don't come any easier.
No.
I've perfected the art of the question.
And more questions come, too. It's just, it seems endless.
Right. I mean, a lot of people say, well, you know, you solve the world's problems. It's like, no, we're just barely learning how to ask what are they? And that's true. The more you learn, the more you learn that you don't know at all.
Exactly. And I think that's an important learning, too, is that, you know, there's much more to know than what we actually know.
I wish I knew everything I knew at 18 when I knew everything.
Isn't hindsight great?
Yeah. I laugh when I hear, young people talking and you know, they have the answer. And I'm like, just wait. You think you got the answer. You don't even have the question yet.
Right.
Yeah. But it's great. It's great. And your book is great, too, by the way.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to slide that in there because, you know, it just kind of makes you think. And that's always a good thing, I think.
I think so. I mean, it not only makes you think, but it also kind of, you know, it introduces you to ideas that you wouldn't necessarily run across in your everyday life. But ones which are really,
I talk about the questions that you know, were bandied around the campfire. And, you know, that kind of question doesn't just pop up in the blue as somebody tries to figure out how to make a cup of coffee in the dark. You know, they start with something they've heard, something they read. And then, you know, as a group, you'd be, talking about whatever, and, you know, they do cross the table, but there wasn't the one involved in this conversation.
Uh-huh.
They cross the table, and you know, you talk about it, and even nobody has any answers. You sort of explore, well, you know, I read this, or there's this interesting person that wrote this, or whatnot, and you know, there are so many questions. I mean, and you do kind of have them here in this book. I mean, the nature of the universe and the search for reality. I mean, what more could you want, really?
Yeah. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, pretty deep, profound question, you know, and it is. But these are also very natural questions. I mean, I think we're wired to kind of ask these cosmic questions. And like you said, I mean, just sitting around the campfire, relaxing with friends under a night sky, these questions, you know, naturally just come bubbling up in us. Doesn't matter what our background is, whether we've studied science or not. I think these questions are, you know, in all of us. We all want to know, you know, why are we here? What's the bigger picture? What's my role in all? So I'd say these cosmic questions aren't just, you know, for high-end intellectuals, but they're for everybody because we all, you know, we all wonder about these things at one point or another.
Well, I think even cavemen sitting around, you know, and you know, after they finished eating whatever they were eating, these questions were started then. You know, who are we and why are we here? I mean, it really isn't about who can get the biggest bison or whatever. You know, there's got to be more. And that it really did start that far back.
I agree. And people have asked the same questions throughout history, and they've answered them, but we still seem to need to ask the questions over and over again, each one of us. It's like we can't settle for someone else's answer. We've got to find out for ourselves. Well, who am I? You know, what is all this for me? So it's not just, you know, eternal philosophical questions, but they're also very personal, too.
Right. Well, you know, it's one thing to have philosophy. It's another entirely to apply it to your life. I mean, it's great to have the idea of the greater good and you know, what's morality and whatnot. But if you don't put it into practice, then it becomes absolutely pointless discussion.
Yeah, it becomes, you know, quote, academic, you know, and, you know, not relevant for everyday life.
And, you know, these are things that are very relevant in our day-to-day life. They affect everything from our jobs to how we pay our bills to even the politicians that we elect. Okay, we may all love to hate them, but, you know, it really does. It goes that far. It affects how that works. Everything is affected by something that on one level you might say is just a academic, intellectual sort of theoretical discussion. But, you know, we take that theory and then, you know, we superimpose it over our lives or vice versa. And it does. It has an effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would even say that, you know, every one of us is sort of living the answer to whatever we think the universe is in our daily lives. I mean, we're acting according to what we believe the universe to be. So it really has a very definite and concrete effect. I mean, if we
think one thing that I've looked at and I've often wondered about, people who believe that people as humans, as we are here on this planet, if that's the sum peak of development, that there is no possibility of life or anything anywhere else, I really think that's sort of cutting themselves off from all sorts of speculation and even higher goals, because if we're the best there is, that can get awfully depressing.
All right, what is there to strive for if this is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I find that whole, ideology of this is it, and when we're dead, we're worm food, and that's all there is to it. Shoot, I may as well be a cat, you know?
That's right. That's right. It's like, you know, what does it mean to be human? I mean, what's like the...
Yeah, there's got to be more to the... more meaning. I mean, why do we need more meaning? What makes us different from the cat that I'm looking at right now? You know? What makes us different? Why are we not like a cat? And, you know, there again, that's something that, you know, that was probably first asked in a cave somewhere.
I think so. I think you pointed to it with the word meaning. It's like somehow meaning seems to be important to us as humans. It's like we need to know that our lives mean something. And we sort of search for that meaning for our lives. Cats seem pretty happy to, you know, eat and sleep and crawl in your lap and... Now, that seems to be enough for them, but for humans,
I don't know. I think
more.
Cats have meaning in their life, and meaning is usually to annoy their staff.
Well, that could be too. Owners. Yeah, exactly. Certain cats are special that way.
Yeah, I have two special ones, so yeah, I know how that goes. Yeah, they're very special. They like to be special. You know, and you know, really, what does make us different? Why do we strive to be more than what we are? Why do we care to educate ourselves? Why do we want our children to be educated? You know, these are all things that daily affect every one of us.
Yeah, I mean, these are all, you know, really good questions, and, you know, I can't say that we really know the full range of answers to them. It's, you know, these are also these kinds of questions that crop up throughout every period of history and every culture.
Yeah.
Why do we wonder why?
The answer to the question of the meaning of life.
That's right.
I always tell everybody, once you find it, then you won't need to live this life anymore.
That's true. Maybe we only find it after we die.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me. There used to be a game way back in the days of Commodore. And at the end of the game, you were going to find the meaning of life. And the meaning of life was that Krog, the bad guy, was going to get you anyhow. You know, so you went through all this solving this little video game, which, you know, compared to the ones that are available today, was really simple.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's funny in hindsight, and the meaning of life was, in the end, Grog's going to get you anyhow.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we're most people I talk to are firmly convinced, I would say it's probably higher than 90%, that our lives have more meaning than at the end we become worm food.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to have that high of a percentage of people that firmly believe this, that what, no matter what their spiritual or religious beliefs may be, and some of them would qualify as an atheist of sorts,
mm-hmm.
But they still think our lives have more meaning than merely that.
Right.
And
right.
So why? I mean, it's not like we've sent a probe into the afterlife and come back with a report. Yes, there's water there. You know, it's not like that. So, you know, how do we become so firmly convinced of something like that?
It's a good question, you know, and the fact that we, you know, don't know what happens after death. I mean, at least, you know, to my mind, not conclusively. That kind of, that only deepens the mystery. It's like, what happens before birth and what happens after death, and, you know, how does it make sense of what's in between those two?
Yeah, I always, and this is one that I said as a teenager. What does the butterfly think, or what does the caterpillar think when it becomes a pupa before becoming a butterfly?
Right.
Does it think it died? You know, and it could be that simple for us. It's some form of pupal state that we don't understand.
Could be.
You know, and why that, you know, that sort of analogy occurred to me as a teenager, I don't know. I guess I was showing early signs of being a little different.
Uh-huh.
But,
you were in your own pupal stage, right?
Yeah, I was. I had this knack of seeing things from odd angles that usually did not make my teachers very happy.
They don't like to be challenged, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, they like you to fit the pattern better. So when you come up with something off the wall, and that would be a little alarming.
Right.
And the caterpillar thing was definitely showing signs of weird.
Well, they used to teach in caterpillars, not butterflies.
Yeah, I guess. You know, I don't know. But, I did. I was kind of like, you know, what does the caterpillar think?
Uh-huh.
Does the caterpillar think it's dying? Well, it could very well be that it thinks it's dead.
Right. But maybe it has to die to being a caterpillar before it can be a butterfly.
Well, there's also that old saying about there can never be construction without destruction first.
That's true. They go together.
Yeah, and that's kind of sort of a painful process as we watch the deconstruction or destruction of where our economy has been. You know, what is it going to? How's it going to evolve? So a lot of people say, all that stuff, that theoretical stuff, it doesn't have anything to do with our life. And it really does, because we're seeing it in action every day.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're living it.
Yeah. And it's an interesting journey. And someone said that there's a Chinese curse about may you have an interesting life, or may you live an interesting time.
Mm-hmm.
Something along those lines, and I'm like, we've got a whole generation that's been cursed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So many interesting things happening right now. And no one knows what it means. No one knows, you know, what it's going to look like on the other end.
No, but it's a very, very interesting journey. I think about my great-grandparents. Their lives went from horse and buggy to seeing a man land on the moon.
Yeah,
and you know, the advent of the computer into day-to-day life, and what will we see in ours?
That's true. We have no idea.
No. And at the same time, you know, I've often said, you know, we've spent the last 150, 200 years exploring science and technology very heavily, and we've made great advances in those areas. But at the same time, we have rather neglected our non-physical development, the things like philosophy and spirituality and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, maybe that's where we're going to see expand next, is where we have not kept up. We're like children that, you know, a kid goes through school and they may be making great leaps in language and lagging behind in math, and then all of a sudden at some point the math skills catch up. And you see that often with a child as they go from kindergarten on through high school. You know, and if you compare the human race to that child.
That's true. I mean,
you know,
Yeah, I mean, these undeveloped parts of ourselves, you know, are crying for attention. And, you know, I think it has very real consequences, because we have technology now that, you know, our morality and our ethics haven't caught up to it. you know, we have the potential to destroy all life on Earth. And it's like, well, you know, is that right? Is that wrong?
And we're seeing all of our knowledge being moved to digital format, which makes it very vulnerable to digital destruction.
That's true.
You know, we could see the equivalent of the destruction of those ancient libraries very easily, with the work of a single hacker, perhaps, even.
Yeah, or a burst of energy from the sun.
Yeah, you know, many different ways. Heck, just even the breakdown of the infrastructure within the United States due to a natural disaster could result in loss of massive amounts of information in the equivalent of one of these ancient libraries.
That's true.
That's kind of a frightening thought sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, you have all these people who like to put forth these predictions of gloom and doom, or these projections of potential gloom and doom. You know, super volcanoes from Yellowstone and the collapse, I forget which island, there's an island in the Atlantic. It's going to collapse and it's going to destroy the entire eastern seaboard with a 2 mile high tsunami.
Wow.
You know, I can't even imagine these things. Where do they come from, you know? Yeah, it's one thing to look at historical, events of massive destruction, Chicxulub event, you know, the Yucatan Peninsula, right down to places in the United States that had secondary craters from that impact. And it's like, that's quite impressive, but that's kind of theoretical, because it happened before there were any people on this continent, you know,
right.
A long time ago.
Right. Now we're spread so far, it's like, we're pretty vulnerable that way, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then they talk about near-Earth objects that barely missed us by, you know, a few million miles, and you're like, is that close? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Closer than we thought, anyway.
Yeah, we do. If you want to get depressed, there's somebody who's willing to supply you with materials to get depressed about.
Oh, sure, yeah. Which is why, you know, your worldview and your outlook makes all the difference. It depends on what you feed.
I find it interesting, too, that the difference in people's perception of events. I was living in New Orleans. The post-Katrina thing is a prime example. Some people were just really unprepared to deal with their losses.
Yeah.
Other people may have suffered the same losses, and emotionally and psychologically, they were much better prepared to deal with that kind of disaster. Yet they came from very similar backgrounds. What was the difference between person A and person B? They may have lived on the same block, even, and worked in the same place.
Right.
But they had the same, and gone to the same school, you know, growing up. And yet they reacted very differently to the events that occurred after Katrina. You know, why? What makes one person able to adapt and one person incapable of adapting?
Yeah, I think psychologists would very much like to know that.
Yeah, I find that, you know, it's really interesting when you're talking to people. Well, for one thing, I like to drag people out into the woods, right? So you see that real quickly there. Some people are just, they're terrified by new experiences. They may refuse to go. They may leave by the time the sun sets.
Right.
Because they can't do it. And other people, they try it, but they really don't do well at it. And other people say, well, you know, it's kind of fun. I may not want to do it again soon, but it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're removing them from their normal environment and putting them in a situation that is beyond a flick of a light switch or, you know, push on a button somewhere.
Right.
And there is no power.
Yeah. It's, you know, outside their normal box, outside their comfort zone.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, people who do it regularly do it because it does remove them from their normal environment and, you know, sort of shifts their perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot different to listen to a bird's call when you're sitting in the dark, and you know you can hear it in the woods, and you're like, "What is that?" than it is to listen to it on a recording.
Right, right. There's something about being there that really sharpens your senses, and, you know,
yeah,
I know, at least I feel more alive.
Well, and I think it's somewhat the nature of females to be a little bit more edgy, I guess I might say, about the unknown. Because even though it's somewhat known to me, anytime you hear a new one, you're like, what is that? And, you know, you may not fly into a panic or anything, but you tend to notice it quicker. It's different. It sounds different. Why does it sound different? Or what's that shadow I saw? You know, women do tend to be a little bit more paranoid in that sort of way. And I think that's just nature's extra kick up because of the difference in physical strength.
Sure. I mean, there's an evolutionary advantage to, you know, being cautious. It worked for our ancestors. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. You know, they were at least a little bit cautious and concerned
about...
Well,
obviously, all of our ancestors survived at least for a while.
That's right.
We wouldn't be here.
Long enough for us to be
here. We're all descendants of survivors.
Exactly. Exactly. So, all these weird things that we do, they must mean something evolutionary because they helped us be here.
Even to the point of, you know, where you're an astronomer, I have to admit, I have looked at the charts of the constellations, and I'm like, you know, I don't know what they were smoking with that campfire, but I don't see where they got this creature out of that. So I really have always had a hard time recognizing the constellations because, to me, it's just a random group of stars. It doesn't look like that shape that they claim it does. And
right.
Been
right.
pointed out to me a number of times, and it's like, no, that makes no sense to me.
Uh-huh.
I cannot see that figure, no matter how far I stretch my imagination.
They were pretty creative.
Okay. Yeah, they were. They were.
No TV,
No TV. Yeah. Oh, I've spent a lot of time looking at the night sky, and I have to admit, I have never, ever been able to learn the constellations. Simply because of that, it's like a mental block. I cannot see a hunter in that shape of stars. I don't care. I can see if I can tell you that's Orion's belt, but as far as how that shape occurred, I just never could. I never could see it. And, you know, maybe it's some creative glitch in my brain, but I absolutely, that's one area that I never really did excel at, was at recognizing those constellations.
Well, or maybe you need to, you know, draw your own constellations and find your own shape.
That might be easier for me because, you know, Orion just doesn't have any relevance for me.
Yeah.
You know, and that could very well be. But, you know, the constellations are something that, like cloud shapes, it's something that people who are outdoors do tend to pay attention to. As they shift through the skies, it tells you about the change of seasons and so forth and so on. I know this stuff intellectually, even if I can't recognize the constellations themselves. But I do know that, you know, the stars move through the sky as the seasons change because of the change of the Earth in relationship to their location. And, you know, they were very small in comparison to the universe.
That's right, because we're only seeing a tiny part of the whole universe, too. Even with all the vast stars in the sky we see, you know, when you're way out in the middle of nowhere camping, it's just a tiny part. So it just boggles the mind what all is out there.
Right, you know, and, you know, there's been many, many stories that were passed down from ancient times about what stars were, because stars played a big part in the mythology of the cultures, hence the constellations and the stories that went with them, and so forth and so on, because they were very obvious. They were something that everyone could see. Where foot travel was on foot, I mean, obviously you saw the same stars all your life. You didn't have to worry about northern constellations and southern constellations because you weren't going to move that far.
That's true.
And, yeah.
People spent most of their time outside, too, which is a big change from, you know, modern culture, too.
Yeah, because we are very indoorsy.
Yeah, we've become that way.
And I wonder how that plays, you know, our place in the universe and in nature within our planet. We seem to be separating ourselves more and more from our own environment.
Yeah, I agree. We seem to settle for like a virtual world rather than the real one that's out there.
I was surprised to read an article talking about the amount of money spent on virtual goods. There's this huge economic niche of virtual goods sales. I mean, imaginary things for imaginary worlds.
Oh, like Second
Life.
That's
rather mind-boggling.
And it's amazing that people are getting wealthy, you know, on, you know, virtual money for virtual goods and, you know, virtual worlds.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of, it's mind-boggling. You're selling imaginary things for real money, you know, an imaginary location, I mean, even imaginary, you know, this virtual real estate. You know, and I've looked at some of these games, and I'm kind of going, I'm not getting it.
Uh-huh.
I'm really not getting it. You know, over the last couple of years, I've actually engaged in various kinds of games, somewhat as to trying to figure out what is the object, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm beginning to develop some theories, but it's like, it really does, a lot of times it doesn't make sense. I mean, how do these games fit into the human experience? Why are they relevant? What are they replacing?
Yeah. Yeah, and even, you know, what's the attraction? What are they enhancing in some ways, too?
Well, it has to be replacing some need of the human psyche that is not being met in the current society. So what is it? Why do we need this? It's apparently a need, just like, you know, religion is a need and so forth and so on. This is some sort of need, and it's meeting this need. But if we can't figure out what the need is, it's like figuring out, you know, what's causing the sickness, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
If we start living in virtual worlds, what will it become?
Yeah, and what will happen to the real world, too? That's the big concern I have is, you know, people are disconnected from nature and the natural world. And that has effects. I mean, our climate is changing because that has effects.
Not only are they disconnected from nature, but it's like a disconnect from each other has been made, and then it's replaced with this semi-connection of the virtual world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the virtual world, people can become a whole new person, you know, with a click of a few buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're kind of going, what does this mean? Why?
Yeah,
and some of the people that I know and I talk to regularly are, I would say, verging on game addicts. I mean, they're really into this game stuff. And it'll frequently come up in conversation, and you're like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't get it. You know, I watched them play these games. I couldn't figure out what the object was.
Uh-huh.
It meant nothing to me. And yet it was very important to them. And, you know, if we can't figure out what this doing, it's sort of becoming a new drug.
That's true, and it's probably fulfilling some kind of need, like you said before. And it's like, well, what's that need?
Yeah, and that I think is an important question for society at large, is what need is the virtual world filling? Is it... Are we missing something in terms of society and community? Is that where it is? Is it from family? Is it from work? Is it, you know, what is causing this desire to live in the virtual world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it is. It's kind of interesting.
What's wrong with reality?
Yeah. You know, why do people always feel a need to find a reason for massive world destruction to occur in a short period of time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I do find this, and this has been going, people think it's just happened in the new millennia. No, this has been going on for thousands of years. The sky is falling. The world is coming to an end.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, this is not new. Why do we feel a need to predict the end?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's almost like people want to sort of press the restart button on life. Like, okay, the world ends, we can start over.
Yeah. Is it really that awful? I don't think so. I think I'm having a pretty good life. Definitely an interesting life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I tend to be an optimist, so, you know, I'm looking for, you know, ways I can contribute positively. And, yeah, there's serious things going on. We've got a lot, you know, on our plate right now, and there's ways we can all help.
And right, what would you think is the most serious question facing the average American today?
Good question. I mean, there's so many. I mean, you know, certainly the economy, our financial system. But
right.
Also, you know, the ecological system, too, because that's kind of the ground that everything relies upon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no nature, no food, you know, no food chain. So if that collapses, then everything above it, you know, also collapses. So
yeah, you know, and we, like this weekend, you know, with my camping trip, I saw, you know, blatant lack of regard for our, you know, the few areas of the natural world that we really have left. People have gone in and pulled down living trees, just twisted and mutilated them for no reason. They weren't even good as firewood. It was sapling trees,
mm-hmm.
young trees. You know, broke glass and threw trash around and tore up roads, making them impassable for a normal vehicle. And did all sorts of stupid, destructive, and pointless things. Why? I mean, why? What did they really get out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, first of all, it's obvious they don't value it, or they wouldn't have done it.
Right.
And that's really the fault of all of us, because we're not teaching young people to value it. Then, you know, if it has no value to them, they're not going to be interested in protecting it. We had some young people, you know, teens in early 20s with us, and I cannot imagine them in, you know, even a partying situation like adolescents tend to do, becoming destructive to, you know, the environment that way, simply because they've been taught to value it. Well, not all kids are. So a lot of them, it's a place to go and tear up and party and have a good time, and there's no repercussions for it. Nobody gets mad because nobody knows about it till later. So they don't realize the sort of damage that they do.
Yeah, yeah, they don't have a, you know, a solid relationship with it.
No, and they don't realize that tree that they just decided to break off for no reason had already taken 25 years to grow and was just reaching the point where it was, you know, thinking about maturing,
mm-hmm.
and now they've stopped that.
Mm-hmm.
And now the process has to start all over again.
Right.
And they don't understand that, or how long some of these plants really take to grow. It's not like they grow in a few weeks, like,
yeah.
you know, a garden lawn or, you know, flowers in their garden or whatever. And nature isn't that quick. Some of these things take a very long time to grow, and it's because of very specific environmental needs. Like soil has not been disturbed for a couple of decades. And they don't understand that these plants can't just be grown anywhere. And, you know, it's the same thing we see in the Amazon. People there, they go there, you know, they don't think anything of destroying it because they think there's so much of it.
Exactly.
Or running out of so much of it.
Right, right. Pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, and if we don't learn to value it, we won't have it. And if we don't teach young people to value it, we certainly won't have it much longer. Because they're the ones that are going to be taking care of it next.
Yeah, it's like I've heard some schools are kind of, you know, cutting down on their physical education programs. And so kids are spending more and more time inside. And so how are they going to value the outside if they don't spend time in it?
And they're cutting down on what was called recess when I was a kid. The recess was, you know, no longer served a purpose. Recess taught you probably as much as the class. You learned how to interact with your peers. You were physically active, running around playing tag or doing, you know, whatever you were out in the playground. You know, I grew up in a school that actually had grass and trees in the playground. So there was a connection with nature. you worked there again. You were physically active. You were outdoors. And you learned a lot because it was unstructured.
Right, right.
And now they're like, everything's structured. Well, you know, you take away structure from these kids that have grown up that way. If they're suddenly faced with a lack of structure for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, a hurricane like Katrina, an earthquake like has hit so many different locations here, you know, in the last year, or whatever event, and the structure is suddenly missing, are they going to be prepared to cope?
Probably not. Probably not. Yeah, and
I saw it even with my own kids. They were not allowed unstructured time. And the schools looked at me like I was a little crazy when I was like, you know what? Them coming home and spending another 2 or 3 hours on homework means it's dark before they've had playtime.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, they don't need playtime. Oh, yeah, they do.
Uh-huh.
They need to run around outside and go stick their nose in nooks and crannies. And you know, mine had about a quarter of a mile radius that they could go around the house. Not all kids have that sort of natural environment around them, but, you know, I wanted mine to have a chance to explore it. That's why I live there.
Absolutely. And, you know, people need to play. I mean, children and adults alike, we need that unstructured engagement. There's something, you know, deep in our psyche that needs to play.
Yeah, I think if you look at our society today, a lot of our play is becoming structured. It seems like a Second Life or virtual world.
Well, video games, like
structure.
You said, yeah.
It's sports. There again, it has order and structure. It's not, let's go out and play catch, or let's go for a hike. It's, you know, no, you've got to have a plan with a map and compasses, and you're going to go from here, and you're going to reach point B at such and such time, and then you'll reach point C at such and such time, and such an event's going to occur, and then everybody's going to march back to point A, and we'll be there in time for this to happen. It's like, come on, what happened to let's just go?
Right. That doesn't sound as fun. Yeah.
Yeah, structure is needed in terms of society, yes, but not always, not everything.
No, I think it's a balance between structure and unstructure, chaos and order. And that's where creativity happens, I think, at that boundary, where structure becomes unstructured.
Well, you know, brainstorming, when you look at that as an event, when people sit around and they're looking for a solution, and, you know, do we sit in neat little rows and stare at one person in the front with a large dry erase board and name off ideas in alphabetical order?
No, it doesn't work. I mean, plus it's
no
fun.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
You put everybody in a room with comfortable chairs and, you know, nice lighting and pass around some refreshments and let them just hang out for X number of hours, you know, all day, fine, half a day, fine, whatever. You're going to have a whole lot more brainstorming going on because they've had the structure removed.
Absolutely.
Now they're free to think.
Absolutely. Just like your campfire conversation.
Or even the one tonight. I mean, we have a time limit, and we have certain things at certain times, but we don't have, okay, for the first 15 minutes, we're going to talk about chapter one.
Right, right.
But I did like, referring to your book, I did like how you started it off with Galileo. That was an excellent, I have to admit, that was an excellent introduction to the book, that first paragraph. It's like, oh yeah, I gotta read this book.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that is. It's sometimes we forget how much can be accomplished by providing a relatively brief catalyst for thinking. When you give people the reins to their own brain, you know, it is kind of an amazing result at times.
Yeah, it is.
It's like brainstorming in a sense.
Right.
What time of day do you find your most intriguing ideas occur to you?
For me, morning. I tend to be a morning person.
in the early in the morning.
So, yeah, I'm most creative early in the morning.
Huh. I would have to agree with you, other than I find my wildest creative ideas, the ones that are most out of the box, always occur in the midnight to dawn conversations over coffee or whatever. And I was talking to someone about that, and I said, why is it that you get the best conversations, the most out of the box? I mean, you know, in the light of day, you may look at some of this and go, you've been drinking coffee way too long when you thought of this.
Uh-huh.
But that's okay, because sometimes you need to really jump out like that. But why do these really great conversations happen in this ridiculous hour of day? Why can't we have it at 6 o'clock in the evening? Well, it's much more convenient, or 8 o'clock in the morning, because they don't happen then for me.
Right.
I mean, I have great ideas individually early in the morning, but not, you know, when I'm talking with somebody else. A lot of times the best ideas occur in the middle of the night.
That's true. I mean, there's something about the night that kind of encourages that kind of...
Well, he had a theory about it. I've always found this an intriguing theory. He said, during those hours, most people in your area are going to be sound asleep. Therefore, their collective consciousness does not dampen your ability to think out of the box.
That's a theory.
Well, you know, that's interesting.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's true, but it's certainly applicable. I mean, it fits the circumstances. That's true.
Yeah.
Almost everybody in your area is going to be asleep. So if it's possible for their collective consciousness to act as a brake on our ability to think, you know, then, yeah, that would work. That would explain it.
That's true. All that noise and chatter is kind of lowered at that time because everyone's sleeping.
Yeah, yeah. And so that you know, that white noise in the back of your head, you might say, is not acting as a brake, and so you can use the back of your head too.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. I thought, well, that's an interesting. And, you know, that was a long time ago when I was told this. You know, in a conversation, and I was complaining about the late in the conversations because there's a natural result, especially for those of us that are morning people. The next day, you feel like you were up all night.
Right.
You are.
Well, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that when people are dreaming, they're probably, you know, more creative than they are during the day. So maybe you're surrounded by more creativity, too.
That could be. I often, when I say sleep on it, let me sleep on it.
Uh-huh.
I mean it quite literally.
Oh,
because
yeah.
In my sleep, I will try out various scenarios to solve the problem, whether it's figuring out how to fix a plumbing problem, figure out how to make something, figure out a interpersonal problem. It's like I can try it out safely in my sleep and find the most likely solution
mm-hmm.
to the problem. And, you know, I've talked to other people, and I say, oh, yeah, I do that, too. So it's apparently, you know, there's the cliche of let me sleep on it.
Right.
But it does leave me tired, I'll admit that, because I've spent the whole night solving a problem.
Well, you've worked hard all night, though, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it is very effective. Because in your sleep, you will try potential solutions that you may not try when you're awake. And you then work through whether the probable results of doing A, B, and C, and, you know, until you find something that's workable.
That's true. And it makes me wonder, it's like, well, what kind of blinders do we wear in our daily life that, you know, somehow we let go of when we sleep? And can we loosen those blinders?
When our subconscious comes out to play.
Right, right.
And our subconscious is definitely a wild child.
Mm-hmm. It likes to play.
Yeah, it likes to play. And it doesn't have the same rules or inhibitions, whatever you want to call them. It can do whatever it wants to.
Right, it can bend reality.
It can reality isn't a rule either, you know. And, you know, I think that's an important part of our psyche, really. Because, you know, it's in a sense, maybe that's where the virtual reality comes in. Our subconscious is like virtual reality.
That's very true.
You know, maybe it's exhibiting a desire to escape reality and just stay in the subconscious realm.
Yeah, or just play in creative reality without so much structure.
Yeah, maybe it is somewhat of a... complaint about the structured way we live today. that we need that escape, and that we need that escape very, very badly, that we're going to devote a portion of our economy, a portion of our attention, a portion of our online time to this virtual reality.
Mm-hmm. Where we can act out these kinds of fantasies that maybe we do anyway in our sleep.
Yeah, like I said, you know, I know mine's a wild child because, you know, well, first of all, I will sleepwalk even, so that disconnect from it's supposed to occur to prevent you from acting out what you're dreaming about doesn't always occur in me. I will, you know, get up and wander around and do whatever. Unfortunately, it's resulted in a few times me hurting myself. But, which is why nature had installed that switch that's supposed to cut you off from doing that.
Right.
And it was like mine would cut off and then turn back on, because what would happen is I would fall asleep, literally, as I was sleepwalking. And so when your body collapses, you tend to crash into whatever is in your vicinity.
Ouch.
Yeah, that would be the painful part. You always woke up then.
I wondered how you got there.
Well, you know, after a lifetime of sleepwalking, you have a pretty good idea of how you got there.
Mm-hmm.
But you're really not happy about the trip getting there. And, you know, there again, that's something that's related to the stresses that we have in our day-to-day life. Because when I'm under the most stress is when I'm more likely to start sleepwalking.
Yeah, interesting.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, when things are running on a more even keel for me, no, I'm not as likely to go wandering in my sleep and go crashing down the desk and get tangled up in the chair.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Having to extricate yourself from this tangle of chair, desk, arms, legs, head.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
No fun.
No, well, you know, it keeps life exciting, you know, living in exciting times.
There you go. There's a Chinese Chris again.
Yep. Well, we have many Chinese products in the American market. I guess that's just another one, right?
That's right.
So whatever provoked you to decide to write Cosmic Conversations?
Well, funny enough, it actually turned out it was a dream.
Okay.
I was, you know, sound asleep in my bed like 10 years ago, and I was just woken bolt upright in the middle of the night, realizing that I'd studied the universe my whole life as an astronomer, and I still had no idea what it is. And there was this moment of, you know, clarity. It's like, well, I really didn't know what it was, but I had to find out. And I figured if I didn't know what it was, maybe someone else would. So I made a list of people I wanted to talk to about it and see what they thought.
Uh-huh.
And then that list grew to more people, and I started approaching these people, and then we started having these amazing conversations that showed up in the book. And that's really where the book was born, was from this insight in the middle of the night that I have no idea what the universe is.
I had one of those insights probably a year ago, and it was, what does the voice of God sound like?
Yeah.
So I've asked many, many people, so I can understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
What does the voice of God sound like?
It's a great question.
And, you know, it was referring to, you know, people that have had prophecies or visions or whatever. And, you know, what are the origins of this stuff? Where does it come from? And so far I haven't found anybody that's been able to give me much of an answer. Maybe I need to be a little more logical about it and sit down and make a list rather than randomly shocking people with, what does the voice of God sound like?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I do get some funny looks over that question sometimes.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is. It's a serious question. I'm not making fun of anybody.
No, no.
I just want to know, what does the voice of God sound like?
And how do you recognize it?
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it just makes absolute sense. You know, what does the voice of God sound like? And, you know, it's an important question, because whether you believe in God or not, you know, if God was to talk to you, you ought to know who you're talking to, right?
That's exactly.
And so, yeah, I want to know, what does the voice of God sound like? And so, you know, hearing you say it came to you in a dream, you know, what is the universe? That, to me, makes a lot of sense, because I do get crazy questions, though, like, what does the voice of God sound like? Yeah. And so you made your list and you began talking to these people. What did these people think when you first asked them?
When I first asked them, you know, what is the universe?
Yeah, but hold on to that thought, because guess what? We're up to break time already.
Oh, okay.
So, folks, do stay tuned to the Dawn of Shades, and we will be right back with our guest, Stephen Martin.